Joe Poznanski, the great sports writer, is back with us. He's got a new book out just in time for Father's Day, The Secret of Golf, the story of Tom Watson and Jack Nicklaus. We remember Joe with great fondness here in Kansas City, where he was twice named best sports columnist in America for his work at The Star. As a senior writer at Sports Illustrated, he was named National Sports Writer of the Year. He's written books on Buck O'Neill and the Big Red Machine in Cincinnati, and he now writes for NBC Sports World. And Joe, so good to have you back here again.
It's Welcome. Great to be back.
Well, this is a book, your latest book, about our Tom Watson and the great Jack Nicklaus. And I wonder if you would describe a scene you have in this book, Joe. It's the last day of the 1977 British Open, and Watson and Nicklaus are tearing up Turnberry. Their head-to-head showdown will go on to be called the Duel in the Sun. The two men are standing on the 16th hole, and Nicklaus and Watson are sizing each other up. The two at this point don't know each other all that well. Tell us first what Watson was thinking, Joe.
It was quite a scene.
Yes.
It's hard almost in some ways to recapture that because, of course, we know how great Tom Watson ended up becoming, and we know Jack Nicklaus is, you know, probably, especially with Tiger Woods' recent struggles, he might maintain that spot as the greatest golfer who ever lived. But in that moment, Tom was just a young guy still trying to figure things out. Jack was this aging legend. Nobody really knew how much he had left. And there they were playing golf probably better than it had ever been played before. They were both 6, 7, or 8 shots better than the British Open record at the time. They were 10 shots ahead of everybody else in the field. And they come to the 16th hole, and it's beautiful. For this book, I was able to go and spend a couple of days at Turnberry, get taken
really?
Around the golf course.
Really?
It's just a beautiful, beautiful place. And that's a very special place. You're high up, and you can see over the golf course and over Scotland, and you can see in the distance the beautiful old hotel they had there. And Tom was, you know, watching the crowd and the scene.
And people are going nuts.
They're
recognizing what's going on here, and there's all kinds of commotion and people trying to get a position to watch this thing.
And nobody had ever seen anything quite like it. I mean, to have two guys playing so well right next to each other, and it was hot, which was very unusual then. So there's dust kicking up everywhere, and people are sunburned. I mean, it's just a massive scene. And Tom turns to Jack Nicklaus and he says, "This is what it's all about, isn't it?" And to have that moment where you can see what's happening while it's happening, you know, to sort of feel history at that moment, it's extraordinary. And Jack kind of looked at Tom with an entirely different way than he'd ever looked at him before. And he said, "You bet it is." And they go on and hit perfect drives off the 16th. And
because Jack is not seeing Watson, he's not showing any signs of stress here. He's handling it.
Yeah.
And Jack's surprised by that.
I think he's very surprised. What made Jack Nicklaus such a great golfer through the years was he had this intuitive sense of when other people were going to crack. And he always knew that he was going to last longer than they were. He didn't really win his 18 major championships by hitting brilliant shot after brilliant shot. Of course, he hit many, many brilliant shots. But it was he always hit the smart shot, and he always hit the right shot. And
yeah.
He would make pars when other people were trying to make birdies, and he would hit the safe shot when other people would feel like it was time to go for it. And so he relied on that, and it worked more often than it's ever worked for anybody else before, where he would put himself in the lead, he would put himself near the lead, and he would stay strong while the other golfers crumbled. And at that time, Tom Watson was known as a crumbler. He was known as a guy who would choke in the final holes, and he believed that about himself. And that was the moment where he looked and said, this is now. Tom Watson had gone from being this great young golfer to now we're rivals. Now we're competitors. And it's a beautiful moment in golf history.
And for Nicklaus, though, Watson may have been thinking that. But Nicklaus, from his vantage point, Joe, Tom Watson really isn't on his radar screen to the same extent, nearly as much as Nicklaus was on Watson's radar screen.
No question. Jack Nicklaus was Tom Watson's. When he grew up, he was an Arnold Palmer fan. So Jack Nicklaus was the guy he didn't like, the guy who had dethroned the king. When he first came on the tour, Jack Nicklaus was the greatest golfer who had ever lived already. And he was somebody far, far beyond his own dreams of just making it on the tour. So Jack Nicklaus was, he had spent a lifetime understanding who Jack Nicklaus was. Jack really didn't know Tom at that point. He knew of him as a young golfer. People were trying to create this rivalry because just a few months earlier, they had played at the 1977 Masters, and Tom had beaten Jack straight up. It's one of the three that I consider sort of the three legs of this book, the three great rival moments. So he was beginning to understand him, but people were saying to Jack Nicklaus, well, is Tom Watson your rival? And he would say, you know, I've had a lot of rivals.
I was going to say, at this point, again, for context sake, there have been a lot of folks come along to sort of dethrone the king, and no one had been able to do it yet.
That's exactly right.
And Watson just one more in a long line.
And that's exactly how he would say it. He would say, you know, I had Lee Trevino, and I had Johnny Miller, and I had Arnold Palmer. I mean, I've had plenty of young guys try to come get me. And I think until that moment on the 16th hole, which is why I think it's where I start the book and why I think it's such a cool moment. Until that moment, I think he thought Tom Watson was just another one of those people.
And that's when it changed.
And that's when they became great rivals. And I think to this day, I still believe it's the greatest rivalry in golf history because three times those two played at their very peak against each other, and that just doesn't happen. We were very, very lucky in the last 15 years to see Phil Mickelson and Tiger Woods at the top of their game, but when did they ever compete against each other? When did they duel? And they really didn't. I mean, there have been very, very few great duels in the history of golf between the very best golfers. But three times those guys had the greatest of duels, and I think that's what made the book so special.
And at the British Open, as you begin this book, they're dueling because they had just outpaced the field, each of them, by so many strokes.
By 10 shots.
They're way out in front.
One of the golfers who finished second said, I feel like I won the golf tournament. He finished third behind those two. I feel like I won the golf tournament. I don't know what those two were playing, you know, because they were just in a completely different level. And to this day, there's never been anything quite like that because it was for 2 days, the third round and the fourth round. At that time, it was Friday, Saturday. They actually didn't finish tournaments on Sunday then at the British Open. So Friday and Saturday, two rounds they played together. And they separated themselves. At the time, they were, you know, they weren't even in the lead. They separated themselves from the field, and then they just kept going and going higher and higher. And that's why people in Scotland, where they obviously it's the birthplace of golf, and they love it so much, people were just beside. They couldn't believe how great it was.
Jack Nicklaus is older than Tom Watson by how many years?
10 years.
Joe? 10 years. And they were rivals at first, who then became friends.
Yeah, it's interesting because that was really the point for me of the book was this idea. I don't know if we can have that anymore where you have great rivals who are also great friends. And I think that that's true in politics. I always think about this, and you would know more about this, but of course, there's great, great stories of people in the Senate who were on opposing sides to the nth degree who would go to dinner those nights. And I think it was just a little bit different time. And so they were very, you know, they grew to be good friends while they were rivals. I would say their friendship has grown immeasurably since they were rivals. But that was, to me, the essence of the book and the essence of the secret of golf. What I talk about is this question of two men who wanted the same thing and had to go through each other to get it, to be the greatest golfer in the world. How did they maintain this great respect for each other, really kind of a growing love for each other? I mean, you look at Tom starting out as, you know, Jack was kind of his hero, his idol when he started out on the tour, the guy he wanted to emulate. Then he had to figure out how to beat Jack Nicklaus, and he ends up doing that for a period of time. Then they kind of grow old together, and then there's this beautiful moment at the end where Tom Watson goes, of course, to Turnberry at age 59, almost wins.
Should have won it.
Should have won the British Open. I think every time I talk to anybody about golf, that's what they remember, and the heartbreak they remember. And Jack Nicklaus at home in Florida crying as he's watching it on television. That scope is amazing, and that's what I wanted to write about.
Nicklaus crying because he's realizing, he's feeling for his friend and maybe realizing that his generation of golfers now has moved off the scene.
I think the tears really began before he realized that Tom was going to lose. I think the tears of joy for his friend, his rival, to see Tom have his moment. I think that was, you know, because one of the stories of Tom Watson is, of course, Tom had that period of time for about 7 or 8 years where he was the best golfer in the world and played at a level, you know, almost as high as just about anybody other than maybe Tiger Woods and maybe Jack Nicklaus in the early 70s. You're talking about as well as anybody's ever played the game, Hogan at his best, that kind of thing. That was the level he was at, and then it ended. I mean, he started missing putts. He stopped hitting the ball well, and he had a 10-year stretch where he didn't win, and he won once, but a long stretch where he didn't win, and the game was no fun for him anymore, and it really was he hated. He told me I hated the game. And for him to come back from that all the way back to almost winning this thing. So I think there was first that great sense of pride for Tom Watson. Second, there was the pain he felt for his friend. And then one probably my favorite scene in the book is Jack calling Tom after that and the conversation they had, which is really fun.
Former Star sports columnist Joe Posnanski is my guest. He's now with NBC Sports World. You can see Joe tonight at Unity Temple on the Plaza. Just call Rainy Day Books and Fairway to grab a seat, 913-384-3126. Let's talk about these two men a little bit more, Joe. Nicklaus, known for his skill, his supreme confidence. Watson brings a little fire to the game that fans loved. Describe these guys, because you get the sense, are they the same men that you talked to, that you saw on the course, or are there differences in private that maybe surprised you a little bit?
I wouldn't say there are too many differences in private. What did surprised me somewhat and made the book much richer was the fact that I think what makes a great rivalry is this. You have two great athletes, Chris Evert and Martina Navratilova, or Joe Frazier and Muhammad Ali, or these two, Tom Watson and Jack Nicklaus. They're the same in so many ways. Jack Nicklaus and Tom Watson both grew up in the Midwest. They both learned the game from their fathers. They both were great sportsmen. They were both great competitors. So there's so much that's the same about them, but then there's tremendous amounts that are different about them. Jack Nicklaus played the game very slowly. He was famous for how slow he played. He would ponder every angle and every shot, and he would drive people crazy because he was so slow. Tom was the fastest player on tour. He'd go up, hit the ball, walk after it, fastest walker on tour, get to the ball, hit the next shot. He was just go, 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 go. And that really sort of reflected how they played the game. Jack was just a thinker. He, you know, it's like we talked about, he hit the right shot every single time. That was how he played the game. Tom, especially in his best days, was wild. He would hit the ball into crazy places, and then he would hit miracle shots. That was they used to call it. He still loves to this day. They used to call it the Tom Watson par. And the Tom Watson par was a drive into the woods, hitting out of the trees, get it on the green, make a 20-footer. So that was a Tom Watson par, and he made, you know, more of them. He was the best long putter in the game in his prime. And so they were very, very different in how they played, and yet there was these powerful similarities between them. And I think similarities in sort of the way they go about their lives as well, and they're both family men and that kind of thing. So it's I like that. I love that contrast and also the similarities.
You know, they played with obvious respect for the game. That comes through even years later, having recalled the way they played, guessing that neither of these men is fond of the way that Tiger Woods plays, you know, with his Tiger's dramatic demonstrations of frustration and all his swearing. There's got to be a little friction there.
Well, there certainly is with Tom. I mean, Tom has been very, very outspoken about that. I think they both feel like Tiger Woods has grown up quite a bit over the last 2 or 3 years. His game has also declined significantly.
Yeah.
But I think that, I think what they believe is the game of golf is different. They both believe this because it is the one game where you officiate yourself. It's the one game where the rules are sacrosanct. I mean, you know, there's a very famous story about the 1968 Masters, I believe, where a wrong scorecard was signed, and it essentially cost a player the Masters because it wasn't his fault. Somebody, Tommy Aaron, was actually the guy who had signed, who had written up the wrong card, and it was signed, and he had to take the score that the card was. And that's a ridiculous rule in so many ways. It's obscure, but that's what the game is. It's a game of rules. They both really believe that. So They believe that the game should be treated with great respect and great, almost to an nth degree. I mean, really, and I think they look at other sports. Certainly, this is Tom. Tom looks at baseball or in basketball. Somebody taking a dive or somebody pretending to get hit with the ball or somebody pretending to make a catch they didn't make. And that's what separates golf. You don't do that in golf. In golf, mm-hmm. if you hit the ball twice by accident, or if the ball moves on you, or you ground your club in a bunker, or whatever the case may be, you're supposed to call that on yourselves. Mm-hmm. And I think they both carried that respect for the game to they were as great a sportsman as the game has ever known. And there's a very famous Jack Nicklaus moment at the end of a Ryder Cup where he was tied. The U.S. had already won, had already retained the cup, and it was tied, and he was playing, and he gave his partner the final putt. He just gave him the putt because he said, I know you would have made it, but I wasn't prepared to make you do it. I mean, that was the sportsman that he was, and Tom was the same way. So specific to Tiger Woods, I think in his prime when he was very difficult around people, when he was swearing publicly and kind of slamming clubs and all that, I do think they felt like it wasn't the best representation of the game.
You tell a story in here, Joe, about getting a phone call from Tom Watson early in your career at the Star. He wasn't calling to complain about a story, which is what you suspected he was calling about. What did he say to you?
It was very, very funny. You know, in my early days, and you might remember this, I used to write a list column.
I remember.
Yeah, and it was just...
I like those columns, by the way.
They were fun to do. Yeah. They were just a series of lists. They were mindless, but I would do, five greatest quarterbacks ever or 10 reasons why the Royals are going to lose or whatever the case may be. And I was always fun and, enjoyable. And he calls me up and he says to me, and I'd never really spoken to him. I mean, I'd been in groups with him speaking, but I'd never spoken to him one-on-one as far as I know. And he asked me, what do you want out of your job? And I said, I don't know what you mean. He goes, do you want to be great? Do you want to be a great sports writer? Do you want to be known the way Red Smith is known or the way Jim Murray is known or Frank DeFord, the greatest sports writers? Do you want to be known like those people? And I didn't really know what to say, and you have one of the greatest golfers ever asking you that. And I said, yeah, sure. Yes, I want to be known that. And he said, then stop writing those list columns because he hated them. And he felt like they were just mindless, which they were. Mm-hmm. Tom never had any use for that in his own game or in the way golf was covered or in my work. That would be what he would complain. It's like, be your best every single day.
You begin the book, Joe, with this line. Tom Watson believes this. The point of playing golf is playing well.
Yeah, yeah.
Playing golf well, absolutely.
He never, because I would always say to him, some people just want to play for fun. And he said, no, playing well is playing is for fun. That's what you do. And he believes everybody should be better. Everybody should try to get better at what they love.
Let's do this. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our good conversation here with Joe Posnanski. His new book, The Secret of Golf, The Story of Tom Watson and Jack Nicklaus. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. Welcome back to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. We're visiting with Joe Posnanski, who now writes for NBC's Sports World. Former Star Sports columnist, his new book, The Secret of Golf, The Story of Tom Watson and Jack Nicklaus. We were just talking, Joe, about this sense of how firmly committed Tom Watson is and was to playing golf and playing it well. I got the sense from reading about him here that he is every bit the competitor that Michael Jordan was, even though we don't think of Tom Watson that way.
Yeah, it was funny because I remember once I'd gotten to know Tom a little bit, we both were sponsors of an RBI Little League team here in town, which is a wonderful program. I mean, it's reviving baseball in the inner city.
Yeah.
And Tom had several teams, and I could only afford one, but still.
Yeah.
And I was in his office one day, and we were talking about this, and I'm walking out just in a joking way. I say, hey, our teams face each other tonight. Our RBI teams face each other tonight, so good luck to you. And he glared at me and he said, will kick your butts. That's what he said. I mean, and he glared.
He's serious.
And he was dead serious. He was dead serious. And I realized at that moment, it really was an insight.
Wow.
He wants to win everything. I mean, mm-hmm. he is hugely competitive. And it was that competitive nature. You know, when he went on tour, he wasn't viewed as really a guy that was going to do much. You know, he'd never won a big amateur tournament. He'd never won an NCAA tournament.
Yeah.
He came in with one of the most celebrated classes in the history of amateur golf. There were a bunch of young golfers that came up at that same time, and he was just one of the crowd. Nobody really thought that he was going to be the guy. And he made a promise to himself and to his family that he was going to give himself 5 years, but for those 5 years, he was going to work harder than anybody else. And he made himself. I mean, this is the true story of somebody who made themselves into the greatest, because he had great talent, no question, but there are a lot of guys with talent.
Yeah.
He would sit out there day after day after day. Lee Trevino tells a great story. He didn't know Tom at the time, and they became great friends too. But he was out playing a pro-am, and he walks by this, and nobody practices on pro-am day. Just the Wednesday of the week of the tournament, they play with amateurs and have fun. And he walked by this bunker, and he sees a young guy in it hitting bunker shots. And he's like, oh, who's that? And that's Tom Watson. He goes, I'm going to keep an eye on that guy. For him to be practicing on an off day like this, that's interesting. And he goes and he plays his round, 5 hours, 4 hours. He walks back by the same bunker afterward, and there's Tom still in that same bunker hitting shots. And that's the obsession he had for the game. But it all, to me, draws from his extraordinary competitive nature. He just wanted to win badly.
You offer a lot of tips from these two men in your book. One from Tom Watson is this: overestimate the wind. Tell us about that.
Yeah. It was, you know, one of the things I wanted to do, I'm not a golfer. I'm not somebody who understands. But both of these men believe that there are certain things that shape their lives, shape their careers,
mm-hmm.
but also their lives in some ways. And I call them the secrets, the secrets of golf. And that's what these are. And my favorite one is the one you just mentioned. And Tom said that most people in general, when they're playing golf, they'll get a wind. The wind will be in their face, and they'll say, "Oh, okay, I'll take a one lower club or whatever." Or they'll say, "The wind will be going left to right," and they'll hit it, move it 10 feet to the direction in order to adjust to the wind. And they never estimate enough.
Mm-hmm.
They always it's a 3-club wind. They take 1 club, or if the ball is going to be moved 30, 40 feet, 40 yards even, they'll only average. You know, they'll go for 10 yards
because
just can't. Because it's hard to do. It's hard to estimate. And I think about that all the time. So he always says overestimate the wind. And I think about that in my own life, and not even for golf so much. I think about how, you know, we're always going up against the wind, whatever it is, trying to get our kids to school or doing something with work or whatever the case may be, to overestimate what the traffic's going to be, to overestimate what mm-hmm. the hassle's going to be, to overestimate how long it's going to take somebody to call you back, whatever the case may be. I really kind of have started trying to sort of adopt that in my own life. I just think it's a really interesting and cool sentiment to overestimate the wind.
Here's the one I enjoyed the most and I need the most in my life, which is enjoy the bad bounces. And you point out that Tom Watson embraced the bad bounces.
Yeah, I think it was what made Tom Watson the greatest golfer, the greatest bad weather golfer that we've ever seen. He did not, I think at first, you know, nobody just comes to this, because
mm-hmm.
it's a skill and a gift. At first, he was like most other people. He was able to move on to his next shot. He did a bad shot, move on to the next one. He'd hit a ball that would take a bad skip, and he'd be frustrated, but he would try to get out of it. But over time, he started to realize that when the ball bounces, kicks into the behind a tree, or kicks into the rough, or you know, hits a tree and bounces, you know, 50 yards back or whatever, it's just an opportunity to hit a great shot. And which I've never who thinks like that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But his caddy, Bruce Edwards, who is a wonderful man who died of ALS almost 10 years ago now,
mm-hmm.
just a wonderful guy, was asked many times. He caddied for Greg Norman, who, of course, was a great golfer in his own time, and Tom Watson. And he was asked, what's the difference between the two? And he never wanted to say, one day he says, you know, here's the difference. Greg Norman would hit a ball that would take a bad kick behind a tree or take a kick into the bunker or whatever. And he would say, why me? Like, why has this happened to me? This is not right. The fates are against me. Oh, the same stuff we would say,
yes,
right?
Yes.
Tom Watson would hit the same shot, get the same kick. He would turn to Bruce Edwards. He would wink and he'd say, watch what I do with this one.
Really?
Yeah. And that is what made him special. And that's really why, he, unlike anybody else, was able to beat Jack Nicklaus at his best. Because what Jack Nicklaus had was he was smarter than anybody else. He hit the right shot all the time. He never made mistakes, all this and all that. But what Tom had was this ability to overcome everything that, and that's why he made him so great in the wind and the rain, where everybody else was kind of feeling sorry for themselves. He thought, well, this makes me the best player in the world because nobody else is going to be able to, hit the shots that I can hit in the rain.
I'm visiting with Joe Posnanski, the former National Sports Writer of the Year, former Star Sports columnist. Joe Posnanski will be speaking about his new book, The Secret of Golf, tonight at 7 o'clock at Unity Temple on the Plaza. To grab a ticket, just call Rainy Day Books in Fairway, 913-384-3126. Now, this is your first book, Joe, after your book on Joe Paterno, the legendary Penn State football coach. You've called that book the best one you'll ever write. Critics have said you were too easy in the old coach. I'm wondering just how much you're glad that book is behind you now.
I am happy, obviously. I mean,
you went through it.
I went through it. I don't know that I'm, I guess I look at it like this. I was just talking about this with a group. The more time goes on, the more that book, the truer that book becomes to a lot of people. When it came out in the middle of this incredible hailstorm because it was just after the time that Jerry Sandusky, his former assistant, was convicted. Yeah. It was just at the time when the Free Report came out, which really pinned a lot of the blame on Penn State and on Joe Paterno specifically. And there was a tremendous, tremendous backlash against a man who had been just greatly admired for many, many years. And I had to, through that, sort of try to see clearly, because I was there to write a story about an American life, and a big American life. And I wanted to tell that story as honestly as I knew how to tell it. And I knew that people were going to view, I didn't believe that Joe Paterno, and still do not believe that Joe Paterno was responsible for those crimes. I think he made mistakes that he admitted, but I don't believe he deserved nearly the blame that he got for this. And I knew that at the time. I knew it. I had investigated it as closely as I could. I had gone through his files. I knew what I was seeing. But I also knew that when I wrote that book, people didn't see it that way at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as time has cleared up and it's not as emotional and people look back on it, I can't tell you how many people come up to me and say, I read your book again, or I just really appreciate that you were able to write a book that was honest in that time, because it would have been very, very easy for me to write a book that just was a hatchet job on Joe Paterno. But I just don't believe that to be right.
What did you take away from having been in the media for so many years and then becoming sitting in the spotlight of the media for as long as you did, as this thunderstorm rained down everywhere? What was the takeaway from you from all that? You walk away with less respect for the media, or questioning sort of what we all collectively do, or did you sort of see it differently?
Well, there were a lot of emotions. Look, there were a lot of people who wrote great things about me, said great things about me and the book at the time when it took some courage to do that, to be honest. So that was an interesting place to be. And you know this, being in it, it's not comfortable for us. We're storytellers. We're journalists. We're not there to be the story.
Yeah.
So to be in the middle of that wasn't a real comfortable place to be. But I also knew that what I was doing, and I believe this to my core, that what I was doing was the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew it then. I think as time has gone on, it's become clearer to a lot of people that I was there to tell the story of a man and a full story of a man. And, I think there were people who I thought were very unfair. I don't know that I didn't know that already. I think the media were a big mishmash of stuff, right? And some of us are terrific, and some of us are out to make a buck, and some of us are out to get our names out there. And, you know, I don't know that I learned anything along those lines, but it is interesting to be in the middle of that storm where you suddenly can see how personal it can become and how, you know, people can say things about you that just aren't true under the guise of opinion, you know? And I think, honestly, I will say this. I think it made me better as a journalist in the sense of this, in this way. I think much more about people that I'm writing about. I always felt like I was always trying to be fair. I never wanted to take cheap shots. I always felt like that was a very important part of what I am. But now, anything that comes along, even if it seems so obviously one way, I try to think about the other side. I try to think about, you know, maybe we're not getting the whole story here. Yeah. And I think that's made me better. I hope it has.
You know, the baseball season is in full swing. The NBA championship is on the line. We have a new Triple Crown winner for the first time in decades. What's catching your attention these days? Well, what's on Joe Posnanski's radar screen?
Well, all three of those things. I mean, that's, you know.
You love it all still.
I love it all. Yeah, the Triple Crown was so fun. I mean, yeah. American Pharoah, and, you know, it had been 37 years since it had happened, and it was great. It really, really was a lot of fun. That the day of the Belmont when he came out there and won. You know, I got to spend some time with the last jockey who had won the Triple Crown, Steve Cawthon, and just hearing his stories and his life and what that had meant to him and what it had meant to horse racing, that was really, really cool. The NBA championship is very personal for me because I am from Cleveland, and watching what LeBron James is doing.
Oh, my God.
It's unbelievable.
I would have bet my mortgage times six that without Kevin Love and without Kyrie Irving that the Cleveland Cavaliers are going down. And as we sit here and talk, they're up 2-1.
Yeah. And look, they still might end up going down.
Of course.
But what he is doing with a cast of, God, honestly, leftovers and rejects from other teams, for him to be, and I truly believe the Golden State team they're playing is a great team.
A great team.
For him to have them up 2-1 at this point, in position possibly to win this series, is, I think it might be the greatest achievement in NBA history. If he wins this thing, I think it trumps anything that anybody else has ever done. So, fantastic stuff. And then, of course, I'm very, very excited about the Royals. And
you're taking my next question. You know, here they are. They have the best record in the American League. And I've heard you say before, you've said it to me before, that you feel a little, I don't know if the word is cheated, that you didn't have a chance to cover a more successful team during all those years you were in Kansas City.
Yeah, I wouldn't say cheated, but I would say I had lunch yesterday with Vahe Gregorian, the wonderful columnist of the Star.
Right.
And I've had this same conversation with Sam Mellinger. Why didn't I get this? Like I went through 15 years, of some real bad baseball, but I love it. Here's the thing I think about, and I think about this all the time. All during that time, even during the worst years, and there were some years, as we know, where it just couldn't get worse, for the Royals.
Yes. I mean, can you believe what we went through?
That's
even
incredible.
Today, you're looking back at the people we would pick for our all-star representative, and who were those people?
Oh, it was amazing. It was, you know, and every so often I like to write, and Royals fans know this, I sort of relive some of the low moments of the years. But they were, at the time, you didn't feel like, hey, they're funny stories. You feel like this organization is just doomed to see. But even during all that stretch, this town still had this baseball heartbeat. I always believed that. And I would tell people all the time, this team gets good and Kansas City will again be as great a baseball town as there is in the country. And I think that's what we're seeing now. I drove through my old neighborhood yesterday and I saw Royals flag after Royals flag. And I just thought, this is so fantastic. It's the greatest thing. And
you know this, Joe. You go out there on a Tuesday night, and there's 30,000 people in the stands.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
And of course, it was that way. I mean, it was that way in the 70s and 80s. And so it's not like this is the first time. But for so many people, for a whole generation of fans, it is the first time. And they're good. And that's the other thing. That's the other thing about this Royals team. Last year, it was magical. But magical things end, you know? I mean, you look at a team and you go, okay, well, they had a great run, but, you know, they could have easily lost that first playoff game against Oakland. They were down 8-3 in that game.
Yeah.
They easily could have missed the playoffs with a bad little stretch.
Right.
So there were a lot of people who thought this is just not that good a team. They are good.
Which is so cool, which is so fun.
Yeah, they're a better team this year than they were last year because those young guys are better.
It's been fun for me just to rediscover the game again and just realize for the first time in years how many exciting moments there are in any one game with the count on whatever. There's just a number of moments, and I had lost all that over the years, and I've raised two boys, or at least my oldest son, who could care less about baseball, missed all the bad years. My youngest son now is just lit up by it.
Yeah, well, your point is 100% right, and I don't even mean this in a sarcastic way. When you're down 6-2, nothing matters.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like you just want to get somebody on base. But when every game is close, and like this team right now, I mean, they're playing great, but they're close games too. And you look and it matters. Mm-hmm. Every game matters.
Yes.
And suddenly it's the seventh inning and a ball gets called a ball instead of a strike.
Yes.
And it matters because now the count's 3-1 instead of 2-2. And it just
changes
the whole dynamic
of
the game. Yeah.
But who on this team, as a sports columnist, who on this team interests you? Who would you like to be writing about if you were sitting here in Kansas City right now?
Well, and I will write about them. There are two guys that to me are so fun to write about. One is Lorenzo Cain, and just because he's such a joyous player.
Yes.
You know, to watch somebody play center field like that is just amazing. And he you know, he didn't play the game in high school. I mean, that's just so interesting until high school. The other is Mike Moustakas, and the reason specifically is I've never seen sort of a transformation like him. You know, he was a certain kind of hitter, always would pull the ball. This year, he just said, okay, I'm going to start hitting the ball to left field. People say that all the time, but he's doing it. He's actually doing it. His batting average has skyrocketed. He's a different player. That doesn't happen.
Yeah.
That just does not happen where you see guys transform themselves into better players over an offseason. So I'm fascinated by that, too.
Joe Posnanski's latest book, The Secret of Golf. You can see Joe tonight at Unity Temple on the Plaza. Just call Rainy Day Books and Fairway to grab a seat, 913-384-3126. Joe, always a pleasure to have you here. So good to have you back in Kansas City for a few days.
Absolutely. Great to be here.
Thanks again.